You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
The French Revolution set Europe ablaze. It was an age of enlightenment and progress, but also of tyranny and oppression. It was an age of glory and an age of tragedy. One man stood above it all. This was the age of Napoleon. I'm Everett Rummage, host of the Age of Napoleon podcast. Join me as I examine the life and times of one of the most fascinating and enigmatic characters in modern history. Look for The Age of Napoleon wherever you find your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to the Explorers Podcast. Today is part 6 in our series on French explorer Jules Dumont d'Urville. I have two notes for today, which are basically the same two notes I have had for most of this series. Note number one, there is a map of our route on the website. Today's journey is going to have us weaving all through the islands of Southeast Asia and the South Pacific, so the map, which was created by someone on Wikipedia and is awesome, gives us a very detailed itinerary of d'Urville and his expedition, so check that out if you want. Note number two, a reminder that we are doing a giveaway of the book Daring French Explorations. It is a cool book, and the giveaway is free and super easy, so check out the website or the show notes on how to sign up. So, last time, d'Urville and his two ships, the Astrolabe and the Zélé, had surveyed much of the Strait of Magellan and then gone south towards Antarctica. The ships had almost gotten trapped in the heavy ice of the Weddell Sea, but they had escaped and avoided disaster. The ships had then gone to the Antarctic Peninsula, where they sighted the Antarctic continent, the first Frenchman to ever do so. Due to the ice, fog, and bad weather, the expedition did not land on the continent or any of the islands. With scurvy taking hold of his ships, d'Urville then retreated north to Chile, where he repaired his ships, took on provisions, and the crew recovered their general health. After that, d'Urville and his ships had gone up the Chilean coast to Valparaiso, which is where he had learned about the death of his youngest son. It devastated him, and despite pleas from his family to come home, that was not in the cards. He had a mission to complete. Nothing would stop him from that. Regarding the health issues of the crew, d'Urville suffered along with them, as his bad diet only aggravated his gout and stomach problems. Add in his personal anguish, and the man was not in a good place. A few things I want to mention before we set out from South America for the other side of the Pacific. First, the expedition had suffered its share of desertions upon reaching Chile. Despite carefully selecting his crew, things happened and men decided to bail from service. The months in Antarctica and the scurvy that went with it caused numerous men to jump ship when they got the chance. d'Urville would fill these spots as best as he could, but it was difficult. Second note, in South America, d'Urville met with various officials from the Catholic Church. He agreed to bring mail and supplies to several different locations, primarily amongst the islands of the South Pacific. But also, d'Urville was presented with information about the abuse of Catholic missionaries on these same islands. British missionaries were often ruthless towards other Christian denominations, especially Catholics. They would prevent them from setting up churches. They would even have their followers harass their rivals. In Tahiti, two French missionaries had been attacked and expelled due to all of the sectarian intrigue. Thus, one of the jobs of d'Urville was to provide support to the French Catholic missionaries, which is something that will come in play later in our story. But I want to stress that while this was religious in nature, it was also an English versus French sort of thing. To support the Protestants was to support Great Britain. To support the Catholics was to support France. It was just another way for these two great powers to pick and poke and prod at one another. And third note, while in Valparaiso, it was learned that there were some doubts being cast about d'Urville's voyage to Antarctica. This was not the British or Spanish muttering behind the backs of d'Urville and his men. This was amongst French ships in the harbor. There were whispers that d'Urville had never actually made it to Antarctica or even entered the Strait of Magellan. They said he had simply sailed to Concepcion and hidden out. One of the officers on board the Astrolabe received a letter from another officer on a French frigate repeating the accusation and suggesting that the only decent option left for d'Urville was to, quote, blow his brains out, end quote. This, as you can imagine, infuriated D'Urville. Such rumor-mongering was not unheard of, as competition for good postings and missions amongst the naval hierarchy was always fierce, but this was particularly vicious. D'Urville responded by holding a dinner aboard the Astrolabe, entertaining some French ship captains and prominent merchants. He wined and dined the group and put on display all the detailed maps and charts from the voyage thus far, as well as sketches of their experiences. All this helped quell the rumors about D'Urville and his voyage, but they were a nasty reminder about the never-ending career jockeying that went on within the French Navy. It was something that D'Urville despised, but he knew in this instance he had to defend himself. The expedition would depart Valparaiso on May 29, 1838. The first stop was just a few days later, on June 3rd, at Masatira Island. This small volcanic island is famous due to the stay of Scotsman Alexander Selkirk. Selkirk had been marooned on the island, alone, for more than 4 years back in the early 1700s. He was the inspiration for Daniel Defoe's novel, Robinson Crusoe. Today, the island is often referred to as Robinson Crusoe Island. Interestingly, it was thought the island was deserted, but an old hermit was found living in a cave, along with his pet goats and dogs. The ship would depart the next day. D'Urville wanted to go to Easter Island, but the winds wouldn't cooperate. Thus, they continued west. Along the way, the Astrolabe would lose a man when he was accidentally knocked overboard. An attempt to rescue him failed. The expedition next sailed for Mangareva on the eastern edge of French Polynesia, about 4,000 miles, or 6,500 kilometers, west of South America. The island and those around it were known to be rich in pearls. The ships would arrive on July 31st after 2 months at sea. The expedition stayed here for more than 2 weeks. An observatory was set up, specimens collected, and the crew helped construct new buildings for the islanders and missionaries. The islanders had embraced Catholicism in European ways, which D'Urville and the other officers found sort of sad. We've talked about this in the podcast. The arrival of civilization had made these people stifled and joyless. No matter, D'Urville would meet with the island's leaders, both European and native. He was interested in the local language, which he found near to the Polynesian spoken in Hawaii, then in Tahiti. D'Urville toured the island and was pleased to find old Mare, religious sites, in the interior. Also, from the missionaries, he heard more stories of the poor treatment of French Catholic priests on other islands. The expedition departed Mangareva on August 15th, and 10 days later reached the island of Nuku'iwa, about 850 miles, or 1,370 kilometers, northeast of Tahiti. The island's vibe was pretty much the opposite of Mangareva, and the crew loved it. Here, the men were able to trade things for sexual favors. The only prohibition D'Urville placed on such things was they couldn't trade gunpowder, as it was extremely valuable and needed for acquiring food. The French would find 8 foreigners living on Nuku'iwa. They would add a few of them to the crew. 2 notes here. First, last time I mentioned Pierre-Marie Alexandre Dumonty, the expedition's phrenologist. Phrenology is a pseudoscience that involves the measurement of bumps on the skull to predict mental traits. Anyhow, Dumonty would always try to measure the skulls of the people he encountered. In many ways, it was comical. Sometimes the people were freaked out by what he was doing. Others were amused. A few times he was threatened when he tried to do his work. Dumonty was always keen to acquire the skulls of native people, and he was known to go digging in graveyards. It's all sort of weird, although mostly harmless. Second note, the expedition's hydrographer, Clément-Adrien Vincendon Dumoulin, and D'Urville's secretary, César-Louis-François de Grasse, would do extensive botanizing on the island as well as on Mangareva. As part of the expedition's final reports, the two would end up co-authoring an entire book on the two islands. The expedition departed on September 3rd, arriving in Tahiti 6 days later, and the situation was, shall we say, unique and evolving. When D'Urville arrived, he found the 52-gun French frigate Venus, under the command of Captain Abel Hubert du Petit Thouars, had recently come to Tahiti. Petit Thouars had extracted reparations from the locals to the tune of £4,000 for recent attacks on French citizens, including some missionaries. He also got the Tahitians to sign a treaty of friendship with France, respecting the rights of French subjects, including any future Catholic missionaries. A 52-gun warship and lots of soldiers will get you such things. Anyhow, I want to pass on this story about Tahiti because it is something that will replay itself on other islands in the region. So what was happening in Tahiti was that the island was being unified politically by Queen Pomare IV. Her people had done this by working with the British, in particular a Methodist missionary named George Pritchard. D'Urville called him, quote, the true sovereign in these islands, end quote. In simplistic terms, Pritchard got guns for the queen and her people. This made them the most powerful force on the island, and the other chiefs, roughly 20 of them, were forced to bend their knees to her. In return, the queen supported the British and harassed the French, which included the expulsion of Catholic missionaries. Pritchard hung in the background, a key and ruthless advisor to the queen. All of this is setting the stage for French rule of Tahiti, but it will have little to do with D'Urville. He would spend less than 2 weeks on the island, and he could see that trouble was brewing. By the way, Captain du Petit Thouars would return to Tahiti in 1842 when he determined that the islanders had violated the treaty that they had signed with regard to respecting French citizens and missionaries. This ultimately led to the Franco-Tahitian War, which I'm guessing most of you did not know was even a thing. Well, it is, and it lasted more than 3 years, and it nearly drove France and England into yet another war. It would end with France claiming dominion over much of Polynesia, including Tahiti. Anyhow, regarding the Tahitian people, D'Urville and his officers were dismayed. The Astrolabe's second in command, Lieutenant Gaston de Roquemorel, called the native people a, quote, dirty and ragged population, which has exchanged its gentleness, its naivete, its primitive virtues, for thievery, drunkenness, and prostitution, end quote. By the way, prostitution was commonplace, but it was, weirdly, encouraged by the church because it made them a lot of money. And that's because if a woman was caught prostituting herself, she was fined by the church. Thus, it became a sort of twisted business model for them. Anyhow, while in Tahiti, D'Urville visited with the local dignitaries, including Queen Pomare. Another person of note was Ramon Freire. Freire popped up briefly back in the second episode of this series. He had just seized power in Chile in 1823, and he'd met D'Urville while he was on the Coquille. The former ruler was pleased to get reacquainted with D'Urville and meet his officers. He had been exiled after the Chilean Civil War in 1829 and was now living in Tahiti. Freire would be allowed to return to Chile in 1842 and live there, peacefully, for the rest of his life. From du Petit Thouars, the captain of the Venus, D'Urville would add a midshipman, Louis-François-René Paul de Flute, the liberal son of a noble. The young man would later take part in the 1848 French Revolution, which led to the downfall of King Louis-Philippe. A coup d'etat would send him into exile a few years later, and he would die in 1860, commanding troops for the legendary Italian revolutionary Giuseppe Garibaldi. The expedition departed Tahiti on September 16, 1838. The next destination was Samoa, about 1,500 miles or 2,400 kilometers to the west. Watching Netflix without ExpressVPN is like going to a casino and only being able to play the slot machines. Why limit yourself like that? The big money is somewhere else. You might know that Netflix has different content libraries for every country. That means you are missing out on tons of great TV shows and films. But not if you have a VPN. With a good VPN, you can control where streaming sites like Netflix think you are located. With ExpressVPN, I can change my online location with just a few clicks. It's simple. I open the app, select the country I want, tap one button to connect, then refresh. That's it. It gives you smoking hot speeds with zero buffering. And with servers in 94 countries, you can gain access to thousands of new shows. For me, it was selecting Australia to watch Oppenheimer and reconnecting with one of my all-time favorites, the Lord of the Rings trilogy. So be smart, stop paying full price for streaming services and only getting access to a fraction of their content. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/explorers. Don't forget to use my link at expressvpn.com/explorers to get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED lights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. The Astrolabe and the Zili arrived at the port of Apia on the island of Upolo, one of the two main islands of Samoa, 10 days later. The French found that the island was dominated by English missionaries. With help from his secretary, de Graz, who spoke English, Derville quizzed Reverend William Mills and his French-speaking wife about the Samoan culture and language. The Reverend would give Derville numerous books printed in Samoan, which he greatly appreciated. Here in Samoa, there was an incident that nearly ended in violence. One of Derville's midshipmen, Pierre-Antoine Delafont, came back to the ship with nothing but his pants. It seems he had been out in search of female companionship, and he had made some unwelcome advances. Not a great move on the now very religious island. He had been stripped and driven off for his troubles. Now, Derville was somewhat amused by Delafont's embarrassing situation. He probably guessed the young man deserved what he had gotten, but Delafont was furious at what the islanders had done. And despite Derville's amusement at what had happened, he was also concerned that the native people would treat his officers in such a fashion. He thus delivered an ultimatum to the village. They had to turn over the culprits who had attacked Delafont, plus pay a fine of 25 pigs. If they didn't do this, Derville said that he would burn down the village and shoot anyone who resisted. When a force of armed sailors, marching with fixed bayonets, arrived at the village, the natives returned Delafont's clothing and gave the French 10 pigs, thus defusing the situation. A potentially deadly crisis was thus avoided. There were other incidents on the island as well, including a few encounters, aka fights, between the islanders and the crew, over what it is not said. Also, Dumonti, the phrenologist, tried to dig up some graves to get some skulls. He failed when the locals figured out what he was up to, and they kept an eye on him. I want to mention that Derville, like many other Europeans, was very much about getting along with the locals, but he did not tolerate what he saw as disrespect. Petty theft, a fistfight, whatever. Derville turned a blind eye to such things. But to insult or attack his men, that crossed the line. He was not afraid to bring out the guns for such things. Anyhow, the two ships departed Samoa on October 2nd. Next up was the Tongan island of Avau, which is about 350 miles or 560 kilometers to the south. Tonga Tapu, which had been the location of some major stuff on the Astrolabe's first voyage, was a couple of hundred miles south of Avau. The ships reached the island 3 days later, and here Derville would get all sorts of information about the happenings on Tonga Tapu. First, his old adversary, Tohofa, was now dead, and the religious site that the Astrolabe had bombarded nearly a decade earlier had been destroyed. The reason for this was that Tonga Tapu was in the middle of a civil war. One of the island's prominent chiefs had converted to Christianity, and with guns provided to him, was making a bid to take control of the island. This is another example of the behind-the-scenes work being conducted by British missionaries, similar to what was happening in Tahiti and New Zealand. And speaking of missionaries, in Vavau, the Astrolabe was visited by Reverend John Thomas. Thomas had been on Tonga Tapu during Derville's last visit there. Thomas was polite and engaging with Derville, but he didn't reveal his role in the civil war on Tonga Tapu or his part in preventing French Catholic priests from establishing a mission on the island. Now, it was here that Derville would also hear about Charles Simonet. Remember him? Simonet had deserted on Tonga Tapu a decade earlier, or three episodes ago. I had said he would come back into our story, and here he is. Well, it seems that Simonet was on Vavau. Reverend Thomas would ask one of the local chiefs to find and capture the man and deliver him to the French to be arrested. And that worked. Simonet was brought before Derville. The man who had been portrayed as a villain in our earlier episode was thin and ragged. He told Derville about the abuse directed at Catholic missionaries. Simonet had personally aided Bishop Jean-Baptiste Pompaye, who had tried to set up a church on Vavau. Derville knew that he had to punish Simonet. It was desertion, after all. But he seems not to have had any lingering animosity towards the man. He would keep him in chains for 5 days before unfettering him and putting him on full rations. Derville was more interested in using Simonet's extensive language skills to his advantage, as opposed to locking him away in the darkness. By the way, I have not really talked about Derville's approach towards discipline, and that's because it simply doesn't come up that often. Derville was not a strict commander. He basically allowed the crew to police themselves. He rarely dished out harsh punishment, such as lashings. I mean, he would do it if needed, but it was not commonplace. It sort of mirrors Derville's approach with the natives. Let people do what they want, so long as you kept it low-key and didn't hurt others or the expedition. That said, Derville was very sensitive to breaches of conduct between the officers, especially if it concerned him. The incident of Valparaiso, where some men had called into question the validity of Derville's voyage to Antarctica, is an example of a time where he was intensely angry. That had been a direct insult to his honor and pride. On October 12th, the expedition set sail for Viti Levu in the Fiji Islands. The Astrolabe also added a Tongan to the crew, a man named Mafi Kalipi, who would go on to be well-liked by the entire ship. After dropping off mail for the local missionaries, the ships headed for the small island of Viwa, and here things were going to get ugly, and Derville knew it. And that is because 4 years earlier, a small French ship, the amiable Josephine, had been captured and looted by the local people. Most of the crew had been massacred. Some stories say they were roasted and eaten by the islanders, but if that is true, we don't know. It turned out that the vessel's captain, Adolphe Bureau, had gotten involved in a tribal war on the island, which had led to the massacre. No matter the circumstances, Derville was here to deal out some justice for the killing of French subjects. The French would figure out who was behind the killings, and on October 17th, 80 armed men in 5 boats, under the command of Lieutenant Dubousset, occupied the island's main settlement. They met no resistance. Within an hour, more than 60 homes and buildings, including the chief's residence, were in flames. After that, the men turned their attention to the destruction of the local plantations, destroying fields of bananas, taro, and breadfruit. I sometimes talk about the relationships between European explorers, such as Derville, and the native people they encounter, and sometimes there's a real level of respect and appreciation that these travelers had for the local people. Derville was mostly respectful during his encounters, but you know what? That only goes so far as the locals cooperate. When there's pushback, it can often lead to violence. The famous Captain James Cook is a classic example of this. Anyhow, the next 2 months saw the Astrolabe and the Zélée go west through the Fiji Islands and into the Solomon Islands. They went from Uvulau to Bua and then Vanikoro, the latter where Derville had previously found the wreckage of one of the ships of the La Perouse expedition. He tried to find the remains of the expedition's second ship, but was unsuccessful. After that, it was north to Chuck, formerly known as Truk, reaching the island group on December 22nd. The expedition spent 6 days there, and to call the time interesting is an understatement. At first, the islanders were welcoming and friendly. The natives tried to get the French to come to their village, but Derville had given orders not to go ashore without proper escort. And then on December 26th, one of the small boats of the expedition was approached by dozens of native canoes. The islanders began to throw fruit and other objects at the French, and then they threw spears. Vincent-Denis Dumoulin's hat was hit by a spear, but he was not injured. It was reported that a pair of naked islanders taunted the French with a, quote, very indecent dance, end quote. We can probably just let our minds go to the gutter to figure out what that entailed. Anyhow, after the spears, the French responded by firing a blunderbuss, which is a short firearm, sort of a precursor to the shotgun. The shot proved catastrophic as it basically destroyed the hull of a canoe, which was packed with native warriors. The two tawny naked guys were then both shot with hunting rifles. The islanders retreated. This incident was not isolated. In a different location, a large group of canoes approached and attacked another of the ship's boats. The French had to fire some grape shot, to devastating effect, to drive off the attackers. And when some of the scientists landed to collect specimens, they were greeted by stone-throwing islanders. No one was badly hurt, and they withdrew to the ships. The expedition sailed from Chuck on December 28th. On New Year's Day, 1839, they arrived at Umatak Bay in Guam. This was the same location the Astrolabe had been to a decade earlier, only that time malaria had been running rampant through the ship's crew. For this visit, their health was much better. Derville would go to the old convent that had been used as a hospital and find the place was rotting and falling apart, pretty much an apt analogy for Spain's colonial empire. The fort that guarded the harbor had been abandoned and was crumbling to pieces. Everything was a ghost of its former glory. The expedition spent 10 days in Guam, conducting ship maintenance and adding provisions including rice, sugar, rum, and even a cow. Next it was west, towards the Philippines. Along the way, the ships would pass by Palau. Here they were approached by some natives in canoes looking to trade. The French found that two of the men who had come out to the ship were Bandanese sailors, now slaves after being shipwrecked nearly a year before. All the rest of the crew had been killed. When the two men asked Derville to take them with him, he agreed. He felt their language skills would come in handy. As you can imagine, this infuriated the Palauans. Those men were their property. Derville was not sympathetic. He was not a fan of slavery in any culture, and when the Palauans wouldn't back down, he had them thrown off the ship. Good for him. The expedition reached the southern tip of the Philippines, but did not stay long before heading south. They reached Ternate on January 29, 1839. Ternate is one of the famed Spice Islands. Along with its neighbor, Tidore, it was the world's largest producer of cloves. The expedition only spent a couple of days in Ternate before continuing on to Ambon. Before leaving, the officers of the expedition would be treated to a great feast by the Sultan of Ternate, although Derville would pass on the party as its gout was flaring up badly. In Ambon, the French enjoyed the hospitality of their Dutch host while provisions were added and the ships repaired. Derville now had some decisions to make. First, he wanted to go to Antarctica again. For that, he planned to go to Tasmania and then sail south from Hobart. The problem was the time of year. It was too late to go now. Winter was around the corner. Second, Derville had been given the option to, at this point, send the Zeelie home. They could just take off to the west, round the Cape of Good Hope, and head back to France. They would be able to bring home all the expedition's documents and specimens. The astrolabe would continue the voyage alone. But you know what? The ships were doing pretty well. The crew was mostly healthy, although a bit short-handed. And having two ships was always a great advantage. If something goes wrong with one ship, you can always evacuate to the second. That's a wonderful safety net to have. And thus, Derville elected to keep the Zeelie with him. And regarding Antarctica, well, he would go there, but not until later in the year. Until then, he would have to find some fun stuff to do. Derville decided he wanted to pass through the Torres Strait, the channel that separates Australia and New Guinea. This is known as a very dangerous passage. To do this would put him on the eastern side of Australia. And so, the expedition departed Ambon on February 18th, arriving first at the island of Banda Nara in the Banda Islands. Banda Nara was famed for its nutmeg plantations. The officers of the ship would enjoy a ball thrown by their Dutch host, but Derville would again pass on the festivities due to his gout. He did, however, enjoy a tour of the island. The ship next headed south, and on February 25th, sighted New Guinea. They sailed along the southwest coast of the island. Now, Derville's plan was to sail from west to east through the Torres Strait. The strait, even today, is considered one of the most dangerous passages in the world. When looking at a map, it seems nice and wide, but it is fraught with perils. At its narrowest, it's 150 kilometers or 93 miles wide, but it is littered with islands and rocks and shoals and reefs, and it's incredibly shallow. Despite being nearly 100 miles wide, the strait is only 7 to 15 meters deep, or 23 to 49 feet. And even more critical for Derville was the time of year, February and March. This was monsoon season. This meant the Torres Strait was filled with a constant stream of gales and squalls. This is, by the way, one of the big reasons so many ships go under Australia. The passage here is just so dangerous. Rocks, shoals, and shallow waters just don't mix with monsoon conditions. The expedition made a run towards the area, but even before reaching the strait, it became clear it was fruitless. The crew was quickly exhausted, and Derville knew it was foolish to go further. So he ordered a ship south towards Australia, or New Holland as it was known at the time, sighting the continent at Raffles Bay on March 27, 1839. This is a little east of present-day Darwin, near the northern tip of the continent. Here, Derville found an abandoned British fort, the remnants of an attempt to set up a colony. It had failed due to the area lacking good soil, which was needed for planting crops. Settlers simply didn't want to come here. This didn't stop Derville from poking around the area. He had an observatory set up and began to survey the region. The arrival of the French spurred the British, who had an outpost just to the west at Port Essington, to come say hello, a way to remind Derville that this was their territory. Port Essington had been founded by the British in response to the French and Dutch poking around Australia's northern coast to dissuade them from trying to set up their own colony. Derville found the area inhospitable. The heat and humidity were brutal, and the region was swarming with ants, fleas, and mosquitoes. Much of northern Australia is right in the path of the annual monsoons. It means it's incredibly wet and steamy during the winter months. The area is covered with all sorts of tangled swamps and forests. It's not great conditions for crop cultivation. Anyhow, the French ships would head over to Port Essington on April 4th. Derville would get along well with the British, as there were numerous natural history fans amongst their officers. They would even provide Derville and his team with a bunch of specimens of the local flora and fauna. Port Essington, by the way, would be abandoned by the British about a decade later due to the lack of fresh water, poor soil, and not enough settlers interested in the area. If Derville had hoped to find a potential location for a French penal colony, what he had discovered in northern Australia was not encouraging. So, it was mid-April, and Derville was still intent on going to Antarctica, but he didn't have to be in Tasmania until December. So what to do? Well, how about a little tour of Southeast Asia? This is the waters between China and Australia. This includes Borneo, the Philippines, Java, Sumatra, Timor, and Singapore. From Australia, the ships headed north to New Guinea, and then it was on to the Maluku Islands before reaching Batavia on June 4th. Along the way, the ships had an outbreak of scurvy, but nothing serious, as Derville quickly brought on some fresh food. The expedition spent 2 weeks in Batavia, which was the Dutch Empire's Far East capital. To demonstrate how important the place was, Derville counted 47 merchant ships in port, along with a pair of Dutch naval vessels. The expedition did some minor repairs to the ships and took on provisions, including flour, biscuits, and salted pork. Derville next headed north, up the coast of Sumatra and across the Strait of Malacca. On June 27th, he reached Singapore. Here, Derville could sense the tension in the air as China and England were at odds over trade. The first opium war was only a few months away. Derville departed Singapore on June 2nd, his tour through the region's islands continuing. This included a stop in Zamboanga on the Philippine island of Mindanao. This was Spanish territory. Derville and the crew would have a good time in port, as the Spanish were welcoming and helpful. From there, the ships continued on, essentially circumnavigating the island of Borneo. On September 24th, they reached the Javanese port of Semarang, where they added provisions and supplies as they prepared to head to Tasmania. Now, a few notes about this little tour through the islands of Southeast Asia. The officers and the crew of the Astrolabe and the Zelee were slowly getting chipped away by illness. Derville was bothered by gout and stomach pains. The expedition had some outbreaks of scurvy, and in July, one man died of dysentery. Another would die of tetanus in August. And then in September, the well-liked Mafi Kalipi died of tuberculosis. By the way, the man's body would be preserved, and his bones are still at the Natural History Museum in Paris. Another loss occurred in Semarang when midshipman Pierre-Antoine Delafon, who was sick, was ordered by the doctors to leave the expedition and return to Europe. From Semarang, the expedition made one more stop, a return to Batavia, this time to get wine and cheese, which had been unavailable at their previous stop. The ships would depart on October 5, 1838, the port of Hobart on the southern tip of Tasmania, their destination. The plan was to travel south into the Indian Ocean and then approach Hobart from the underside of Australia. However, it was not long after departing Batavia that the first signs of dysentery appeared. That in of itself isn't surprising, but it very quickly became clear that this was a much more serious situation. Within a month, five men were dead and dozens were sick. Derville was likely sick as well, since on November 1st, he drafted a detailed will. He gave his property to his son and his money to his wife. He thanked his officers and crew and gifted them 350 liters of wine to be dispensed for 4 days a week at the hour of his last breath. He left his head to Dumonti, the phrenologist. He asked that his body be laid to rest at sea, except for his heart. His heart was to be saved and sent to his wife. Lucky her. Now, during this time, there was an odd incident when L. Jean-François Legayou, the surgeon aboard the Zelee, took a boat over to the Astrolabe to talk with Derville. Because so many men were sick, he urged his commander to abandon the mission and head west to Mauritius. He said that he had 20 men with dysentery. The sick men were causing the rest of the crew to grow exceedingly anxious. Now, all of this may have been true. The problem was that Legayou had come over to the Astrolabe without talking to his commanding officer, Charles Jacquinot. This was a serious breach of etiquette aboard a naval vessel. You simply did not go behind the back of your commanding officer with such a request. Legayou said he did this due to his genuine concern for the crew, which is probably true, but as I said, he was really out of line in this situation. Derville would consult with Jacquinot, who was appalled by what his surgeon had done, and the expedition continued to Hobart. Derville, by the way, would never forgive Legayou for his conduct. The cases of dysentery would only grow as the ship sailed under Australia. More deaths would follow, including one of Astrolabe's ensigns, Jacques-Marie Eugène Marescot du Tilleul. The young man had been well-liked and respected by everyone. His father was also a friend of Derville's. And that wasn't it for the deaths. Jean-Marie Émile Gourdin, the Astrolabe's youngest ensign, passed away a short time later. The expedition sighted Tasmania on December 11th and soon arrived in Hobart. Three of the men from the Astrolabe and 15 from the Zelee would be hospitalized. Six would die. Hobart was a very different place than the one Derville had visited a decade before. It had tripled in population, and the territory's governor was Sir John Franklin, who we discuss in depth in the Lost Franklin Expedition series. In Hobart, Derville would meet Franklin along with his formidable wife, Lady Jane Franklin, and he and the crew would have many invitations for Christmas festivities. But Derville said it was a mournful time due to so many deaths amongst the officers and crew. Now, it was in the last weeks of 1839 that D'Urville turned his attention towards Antarctica. He and his ships readied for the voyage. The sails and rigging were mended and repaired. The rudders were taken apart, inspected, and fixed. And food and supplies were added. D'Urville even got to meet with Captain John Biscoe, who had recently become only the third person to circumnavigate Antarctica. On a troubling note, D'Urville also learned that an American expedition of exploration under the command of Charles Wilkes was in Sydney, intending to head to Antarctica any day. D'Urville was, as you can imagine, anxious to get moving. However, he was concerned about the number of men available to him. I don't know the exact number, but the expedition had lost at least 24 men over the past 6 months, maybe more. Because the ships were short-handed, D'Urville brought up the idea of leaving the Zélée in Hobart and heading to Antarctica with just a single ship. Charles Jacquinot argued vehemently against this. A single ship in polar waters was in an immensely dangerous situation. So much could go wrong, and if you did lose a ship, having a second one nearby would at least allow you to evacuate the crew to the second vessel. D'Urville would give up the idea of a lone ship after some of the sick men got healthy and recruits were added in Hobart. This included 6 Frenchmen, deserters from whaling ships. Plus, there were 6 English recruits. Some of these were likely escaped convicts, but D'Urville could not be choosy at this point. And so the two vessels readied for their journey south. There was a ball given by Lady Franklin on New Year's Eve, but not before a couple of more funerals. The expedition would lose master carpenter Joseph Coutelang, as well as the official artist Auguste-Ernest Goupil. Goupil had been described as friendly and gentle and was well-liked by all of his comrades. And so that takes us to 1840. At 2 a.m. on January 2nd, the Astrolabe and the Zélée would depart from Hobart, their destination, Antarctica. And that is where I will leave things for today. Next time, we will wrap up the second voyage of the Astrolabe and our series on Jules Dumont D'Urville. I hope you've enjoyed the story. Thank you for listening. I will see you next time. The Explorers Podcast is part of the Airwave Media Network. Go to airwavemedia.com for other great shows, including Bad Watchdog and The Box of Oddities.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.